For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good evening. The last several days, Alan Sanocki from the Berkeley Zen Center has been here speaking, talking in various ways about the three refuges. I spoke a little bit about that last Monday. I wanted to just review some of the some points that he made and then have some discussion. So now, I wanted to respond a little bit. So most of you were not here for his talks, but I wanted to share a little bit. So Saturday he spoke at DePaul University about radical Buddhism and the three refuges, and he posed them as liberty, equality, fraternity, based on formulation of Dr. Ambedkar, who was one of the three figures he talked about. So again, I'm just going to touch on some main points of a little bit of what he said. If anyone's interested, I have the text of his Saturday talk. I can send you the document. But in talking about this, he first talked about Shakyamuni Buddha and the situation he was in 2,500 years ago in what's now northeastern India. One thing that Alan said is that he was calling this radical Buddhism, but in a way it's redundant. The Buddha's teachings were, so I'm just going to read a little bit from Alan's talk. The Buddha's teachings were radical for their time and place, and for ours. The Latin etymology of the word radical means going to or forming one root, forming the root. The first dictionary meaning is relating to or affecting the fundamental nature of something. So this is our practice, whether we formally do the ceremony of taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, just to come and sit zazen, is in some ways to look for the fundamental nature of things. So he said, so Alan said, the Buddha quest was to realize the fundamental nature of being and to become free from delusion, thereby from the endless cycle of birth and death. He did this by going to the root of his mind and by extension the source of all his actions, and then spent the next 45 years creating a community and with them traveling and teaching throughout northern India. So, and he invited his followers to take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, originally in an order of monks and nuns, but this has a deeper meaning as Buddhism evolved, awakening or the awakened one. Dharma is the truth and the teaching about it, and Sangha community. But he talked a lot, Alan talked a lot about Dr. Ambedkar, who's a very important figure, mostly unknown in American Buddhism, maybe only recently, and in some significant part thanks to Alan and his work. Dr. Ambedkar lived, I'm not sure his dates, but he was born into the untouchable caste, and the untouchable caste is still a part of the Indian Hindu caste system, but really treated very, very poorly. They have the lowest jobs, live in constant fear of being publicly humiliated, paraded naked, beaten, and raped with impunity by upper caste Hindus seeking to keep them in their place. Merely walking through an upper caste neighborhood is a life-threatening offense for one of the untouchables. In rural areas, this is according to statistics from a little while ago, but not so long ago. In rural areas, 37.8% of government-run schools make Dalit children. Dalit is the name for the untouchables. Sit separately from other children. In 27% of rural villages, Dalit are prevented from entering police stations, even if they want to report something. In 33% of rural villages, public health workers refuse to enter Dalit homes. 48.5% of Dalit villages are denied access to water sources. So this is a pretty terrible situation. 70% of rural villages in Dalit are not, and non-Dalit cannot eat together. So that's the situation that Dr. Ambedkar was born into, but he was extremely bright, and he found a patron who was able to, helped him to go to prestigious Bombay University. He won a scholarship there and then ended up getting scholarships and doctorates from Columbia University in New York and the London School of Economics, and passed the bar and became a lawyer in London, and then came back. So he's one of the best educated men in India. He was a kind of colleague and peer and an actually rival of Gandhi, and that's a whole complicated story. But one thing that happened in the 40s, this actually started earlier for Dr. Ambedkar. He realized that for the Dalit people, living as Hindus in India was untenable, and he did a study. He decided to study what was the best religion for himself, but also for his people. And actually, so it was earlier. By 1935, Dr. Ambedkar concluded that. That was when he started his research, and he resolved to leave Hinduism. He said, "I was born a Hindu, but I won't die a Hindu." And after studying Christianity and Sikhism and Islam and various religions, he decided that Buddhism was the best religion. He saw the rational side of Buddhism, in 1956, finally converted and took refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha. And then in October 1956, did this radical thing of turning around. He received the five ethical precepts, which are common as lay precepts, and turned around, and there was a gathering of 400,000 untouchables to witness this, and he converted them immediately. And there is now in India, where Buddhism started, a large millions of Buddhists, thanks to Dr. Ambedkar. There are also Buddhist communities, thanks to China and their expulsion of His Holiness the Dalai Lama from Tibet. But many centuries, there was no Buddhism in India. So this is a very modern situation, and Alan is very much involved with this community. He goes every year and teaches there, and it's in southern India. And Dr. Ambedkar passed away about 6 months after the conversion. So I had heard that, and I had thought I wasn't sure that that really any significant community developed out of that, but they continued. And so in the 2001 census put India's Buddhist population at 8 million. More than 90% were from the Dalit communities, the untouchable communities. And Alan, again, has been going and teaching there, and the communities are fairly activist, engaged Buddhists. The Friends of the Western Buddhist Order teachers from starting from England also have been going there. One thing about Dr. Ambedkar and taking refuge, this is a quote from Dr. Ambedkar. Positively, my social philosophy may be said to be enshrined in three words: liberty, equality, and fraternity, which we could take as community. Parallel to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But Dr. Ambedkar said, let no one, however, say that I have borrowed my philosophy from the French Revolution. I have not. My philosophy has its roots in religion, not in political science. I have derived them from the teachings of my master, the Buddha. So it's an interesting modern way of thinking about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And it makes sense. Liberty, liberation, Buddha is about awakening and being free in some radical sense. Equality, the Dharma is about the wholeness and the oneness of things. So this, so in social terms, equality. You know, we could see that as a reflection of Dharma, and then community and the importance of community. So this is a modern Indian understanding of Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. So this is an interesting way of thinking about this. Alan, on Saturday, also spoke about Dr. King, Dr. Martin Luther King, and his teaching about the beloved community. So talking about how the practice of taking refuge, the practice of, well, including meditation, ethical conduct, and insight, has always been rooted in some ways in community life. So, again, the Buddha founded an order of monastics and monks and nuns. What we're doing here and throughout most of American Buddhism is applying this to this kind of lay community, non-residential community. There are places to go to experience the value of residential practice, but this idea of community parallels in many ways what Dr. King called the beloved community. And Alan said a lot about this, but there's a description that Alan quoted from the Martin Luther King Center in Atlanta. Dr. King's beloved community is a global vision in which all people can share in the wealth of the earth in the beloved community. Poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of sisterhood and brotherhood in the beloved community. International disputes will be resolved by peaceful conflict resolution and reconciliation of adversaries instead of military power. Love and trust will triumph over fear and hatred. Peace with justice will prevail over war and military conflict. So this is the vision of Dr. King and beloved community. And in some significant way, this is what our practice tradition is about, this turning to Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. and or we could say liberty, equality, and community. So this is a modern way of looking at it, but and an ideal way of looking at it. But in terms of what Alan was talking about, engaged Buddhism, and in some sense all Buddhism is engaged. I mean, disengaged Buddhism is not really a way of awakening. But what that means in terms of our practice and how we respond to the world around us. So our main practice in some ways is just this sitting we've just done, just sitting, zazen, facing the wall, facing ourselves, facing our own personal situation, being present to thoughts and feelings, sensations, discomfort, loss, sadness, and joy. And yet we recognize our deep connectedness to all beings. So, you know, Alan was talking about this in various ways, and I talk about this in various ways. In his talk yesterday morning out here, Alan emphasized the way of talking about this of Bernie Glassman, who passed away a couple weeks ago and who we did a service for a couple Mondays ago. He founded the Zen Peacemakers Order. Maybe you all know, do you all know about Bernie Glassman? He was a leading successor of Maizumi Roshi from the Zen Center of Los Angeles, but was a character. He really was. He was funny and outrageous, and at some point put away his robes and led a community. Also practiced at being a clown. I mean, formally he took lessons in clowning and wore, you know, a red rubber ball on his nose sometimes. And, you know, anyway, he was an interesting guy. But he founded this Zen Peacemakers Order. And Alan talked about the three tenets and of the Peacemakers Order, which really could be, parallel to Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha in some ways. The first of the three tenets is just not knowing. This is so important in our practice. This is, you know, what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind. It doesn't mean that we don't know some things, but that fundamentally we can't get a hold of some set definition or knowledge and use that to decide, you know, who we are and what we should do and so forth. So this openness is another way of talking about that. Openness to learning more, openness to hearing others, openness to, you know, it doesn't mean expressing. So we do. You know, I would encourage you all to express your sense of awakening, your sense of zazen, heart, mind, your sense of awareness that grows. It's not a set thing that grows and opens in sustained zazen practice, sustained meditation practice. We don't hold to fixed views. So Buddhism is not dogmatic. There have been branches of Buddhism that maybe have strayed there, but basically just to not know, which means to be curious, to ask questions, to wonder, to enjoy what is wonderful. And I want to come back to that at the end. So that's the first one. The second one, which is very deep, is bearing witness. So Bernie particularly led sessions or long retreats at Auschwitz, at Native American sacred places or places where reservations, also street witnesses, having people go out into the street with no money and just for a week be kind of homeless. And in some ways this is artificial because, you know, at the end of the week they could go back to their whatever degree of comfort they had in their homes, but just to witness to what it's like to be out on the street. This bearing witness is a deep practice. In some ways, it's what we do in Zazen. We bear witness to our own heart minds, to our own confusion, to our own fears and aspirations. But just to pay attention, not necessarily to do anything about it, just to witness, is a deep part of our practice. And we have in our Sangha many people who are either working as chaplains or hospice helpers or studying to do that. And that's one form, deep form of bearing witness to life and death, to illness, to suffering. But all of us, we can bear witness to the confusion in our own seats and also to what's going on in the world and the confusion to that, just to pay attention. So that's the second. And in some sense, that's what the Dharma is, to learn, to be open to learning, to see what is true, but not to hold on to some particular idea of what that is, not to hold on to our fixed idea of ourself or of what reality is. The third one is what Alan talked about how Bernie changed this his definition of this, but initially it was just loving action. And Alan said that he saw it as appropriate response, which is one of our main koans. Yunmen said, when asked what the whole life of the Buddha was, he said, an appropriate response. So this comes back then to, well, how do we pay attention, bear witness, and how do we appropriately express loving action in the world? Alan quoted one, Bernie's last words, challenging words in an interview. Whenever you hear anything and whenever you say anything, say, keep in mind that this is my opinion. I'm not saying this as truth or fact. It's my opinion. This comes from The Big Lebowski, and Jeff Bridges and Bernie were friends, and, you know, the dude says, hey man, that's just my opinion, you know. So we can say that about our own, about everything, you know. It's just our opinion. Some opinions may be more helpful than others, or you know. Bernie said, if you hear somebody saying something, that's their opinion, and opinions cannot be right or wrong. Those are my parting words. With that, you won't have any problems. So I want to talk a little bit more about that, and then just, you know, hear comments and appropriate responses from all of you. How do we respond appropriately? And, you know, I'm thinking again more always this week about a guy I know in California has called climate trauma. We're all traumatized by the reality of the climate disaster that our world is going through. And, it's, you know, we can't, it's a kind of, it's like PTSD. It's a kind of trauma that we can't, we don't know what to do, what to say. But, you know, the floods in the southeast, the fires in California are just horrendous and very much enhanced, scientists are clear, by what the fossil fuel companies have been doing since they knew about these effects 30 years ago, more. and I, you know, Alan had to go back to to the Bay Area where the air quality is really terrible, and he got extra masks here because they've run out of them there. People are wearing masks, and somebody I was trying to reach today didn't respond to her phone or text, and I emailed her, and she said, "I'm sorry, I'm just not able to really do much. I'm really sick because the air is so bad." And she was hoping that tomorrow evening is supposed to rain, and maybe it'll get a little better. But people are really sick. All the people who've been displaced, all the people, there's over 600 missing, and I don't know, the last count I saw 70 dead. This is an effect of this. And one of the things that's happening in California, and maybe you all know this, but maybe you don't, that a significant number of the firefighters are prisoners, incarcerated people, and they're on the front lines of fighting the fires. They get, for every day they're out there, they get some time taken off their sentences. They also get paid $1 an hour to be on the front lines in the most dangerous place fighting the fires, and these huge fires. And, you know, one of the, so it's, you know, is this slavery or, and the California state is saving $100 million a year by having incarcerated men, women, and children. There are camps, including a children's camp, who are fighting the fires. There's California saving $100 million a year by using prisoner labor to fight the fires. And maybe most horribly, after the prisoners get out of prison, they're not eligible to get jobs as firefighters, even though they've been trained and had all this experience, because they're former prisoners. It's just like this catch-22. You know, this is just another example of what's happening and what we can bear witness to. So, what is an appropriate response? What is a loving response? The situation with the floods and the fires and things happening all around the world, you know, terrible things, floods in South Asia. A lot of the refugees coming from Central America, they're fleeing governments and gangs and violence. But some of that has to do with climate, too, because the coffee crops were failing. And so people from the countryside moved into the city where they were susceptible to gangs and so forth. So, I don't know, it seems to me we need a defense department to defend us from the fossil fuel companies and the government that they own. But how do we respond to this? How do we witness to it? First of all, witnessing is part of it, just to pay attention. How do we not, It's traumatic to even think about it. It's this existential threat to not just human life, but the life of all large animals. Something will survive, clearly. So, you know, it occurred to me that this week we are celebrating Thanksgiving. So, of course, along with the difficulties, there are many things to enjoy in our world, things that are wondrous, things that we can wonder about, family, friends, just everyday, the everyday satisfactoriness of things. But really, appropriate response, this loving response, might be summed up as Thanksgiving, as seeing what we can be grateful for, and then giving back in some ways, to, in whatever way we can, to the situation. So I think I'm suggesting that Thanksgiving is another name for this third tenet of Bernie's. We have a little bit of time for discussion. And if anyone who was here Saturday, was there Saturday or Sunday, and wants to add something, can, or just to whatever I've been saying, I'm interested in your responses. So please feel free. Thank you. So to take refuge in not knowing, to take refuge in witnessing, to take refuge in appropriate, helpful response, loving response, Thanksgiving response. And did you have something?
I was thinking on Sunday, the temple Saturday and Sunday, maybe each was the same, each talk was special. And on Sunday, there was mention of Bell's involvement with the nonviolent confrontation training.
Yes.
With the Southern Poverty Institute, during the civil strife of the late '68, '67.
Yeah.
And that these trained trainers would have the people, the volunteers, play act.
Yeah. Yeah, I've participated in such role plays also, of playing the policeman, playing the protester back in the 60s and since. And to see the different sides and the different positions. And then, as you said, to see that within ourselves, our own, you know, capacity to oppress ourselves as well as others, and to feel oppressed, and how do we negotiate that from this place of witnessing and loving action. So yeah, very powerful way of looking at things. Thank you. Other reflections, comments, responses? Dennis.
Yeah, I'll just say in passing, I met Bernie Glassman once and heard him speak, which was really a great experience. I remember I was at a bookstore he was, we all got together in the book group, and everybody said to him, why do you as a Buddhist think so much about pain of other people? And so Bernie said, if my one hand is wrong, shouldn't my other hand go away from it? You know, I've never forgotten that.
That's a great
response.
Yeah.
But my wife and I have been talking a lot lately about how change is so threatening and scary to people that they try to respond to change with violence.
Yeah.
In a sort of futile attempt to stop the change from happening. We've been talking about it. She said the other day, you know, think about how fast social change has happened in America, you know, civil rights and women's rights and gay rights and so forth. And then this is, the speed of it is probably more than many people can cope with. You know, I just throw that out. But I think she had a really good point there that, you know, they become afraid and angry and sometimes react with violence to try to stop that, you know, try to blame something for what's driving me crazy.
Yeah, well, part of the first noble truth is that there is discomfort, dissatisfaction, suffering, old age, sickness, death, oppression, all kinds of difficulties. And yeah, I think that's true in the world that's where there's a lot, where change is happening relatively quickly. Some people get left out. Some people feel threatened. And then we have, you know, politicians taking advantage of that and saying, well, just blame those people, and if we can build a wall and keep them out, then you'll be okay. And, of course, that doesn't work. But, yeah. But trying to see, not trying to see, as you're indicating, you know, different sides and the fear and suffering of, you know, the other hand as opposed to this hand. Yeah.
Well, might I say one other thing?
Please, sure.
One response to that that has been pretty good is for the people who are the object of that anger, you know, to actually get to know the people who are, you know, who are part of the oppressor group and have conversations. And one example of that, I don't know how many of you have seen those wonderful Queer Eye.
Yeah.
I think it's on Netflix. But, you know, it's really interesting and heartening that when people actually get to know despise on a personal level, a real connection is formed, and suddenly the fear, anger, and hatred starts to dissolve.
Yeah, just to communicate. Yes, Gershon.
So, less than 24 hours ago, I got back from being released in a Buddhist country, and it was very interesting, and I haven't processed it yet, but everybody talks about the three poisons all the time. Everybody talks about climate change all the time. 72% of the country is forest, and in their constitution it says it can never go less than 60%, and it's the only country in the world that's carbon negative.
That's what?
Carbon negative.
Oh, good. This is Bhutan?
Bhutan?
Yeah. And it's not perfect. But everywhere in pictures, it's a democratic monarchy, so they have a king with the kindest face you've ever imagined. Everywhere. And it's a beautiful movie star, Gordie Ford, and child who radiates joy. Everywhere.
That's great.
It's not perfect at all, but it was interesting to see explicit explicit implementation of Buddhist principles in a government. And I think about it a lot more. But it seemed like a good thing. It seemed really good. I mean, it seemed to work in a lot of ways. Which I think, you know, I wasn't sure about that. And there were places that, I mean, there's some prejudice. They're terrified of China. They work with India. They're their two neighbors. But they want to keep Bhutan Bhutan. So they don't want a lot. There's only 700,000 people in the whole country. I mean, less than, there's probably apartment buildings in Chicago. And I don't know if it would work on a world scale, but it sure is an interesting idea, isn't it?
Yeah, somebody said, give peace a chance. I don't know. Anyway, imagine. Yeah.
I have jet
lag,
so excuse me.
Excuse me. Thank you. No, you're... No. Oh, good. Yes. Good.
Yeah, I have to have a guide. You can't go there without a guide. They don't let people just come. So we had all day long a person telling us about Buddhism. All day long. Fascinated that I was an American Buddhist and kept asking questions about it.
Great. Good. Well, thank you for that. Unless there's some last comment, maybe on that note we can close. But does anybody else have something they wanted to share? Okay, let's close with the four Bodhisattva vows.